I'm going to start straight off into the question time. There's so much to pick, Larry. It's such rich work to go from. I can't quite decide where to start. I think starting with that last piece, what an amazing film that held us spellbound. The visuals were spectacular and stunning, so poetic and beautiful. Can you talk a bit about where the text comes from and how you decide to put that text in that landscape?
Yeah, sure. I think picking up from where I mentioned earlier on in the presentation with the Finding Phantom project with David, we just came up with so many ideas that we'd written. Some things just weren't going to make their way into that. And there were a few things that I'd been working with, and I wanted to, I think as a result of our kind of collaborating on Finding Fanon and bringing Hayley Joy Rose, who did the other voiceover for all of the other scripts, kind of made them her own as well. She edited the scripts that we'd written. I wanted to create, I guess, additional scripts that didn't feel like they were coming from a, you know, a black male perspective, but maybe that of a female or even, you know, queer perspective. And I'd invited Nefertiti Eboshi-Shandorf, who got me to work on a group show about a year or so before, and she was just so impressive with her gusto and flow that I wanted to, you know, collaborate again. And so I told her a little bit about the Relic Traveler project. I don't really talk about ideas with people until the work is out there. So I think her or maybe one other person knew about that. And she thought that it was an amazing idea that just needed to, you know, to be put out there. And so she's really the only person who I shared the developed scripts with. She in fact voices, does the voiceover for Relic Zero, which of course is, you know, it's the prelude to Relic One. Of she kind of, I guess, she becomes this character, this maybe general or leader of something. You don't know what it is, but obviously she's in charge of the program of the other Relic Travelers. So also when I guess I was coming toward the end of writing the script, you know, the Grenfell tragedy had happened, and Khadija Saye, a friend of mine, and those of us who exhibited with her in Venice, that hit a really kind of tough nerve. I mean, of course, even now as well, just the fact that something like that could happen in the West, let alone the UK. Something so fucked up, criminal, and more. It felt like some of that energy needed to go in there. I mean, already there was going to be this piece of writing that spoke about, you know, race as if it were this consuming, you know, spirit. But I think just at that point we were working on, you know, kind of post-production, and that had happened. We kind of, you know, those of us, we banded together and felt that needed to come through somehow as well.
So did it change a lot at that point?
I think it added to the intensity. It added to the intensity for sure, yeah.
That certainly, the intensity certainly comes across. However, the juxtaposition of the child and those huge brutalists listening makes it go both forward and backward in time too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was the when we were drawing up ideas for Relic Traveller, I wanted to try and find sites where you're looking at technology, you know, defunct technology, but thinking about a lot about audio. You know, there's this, you know, the object that shows up throughout the film, the shell, which, you know, kind of alludes to this potential testimony existing within that. We tried to shy away from it being, I don't know, like some type of digital device or whatever, because I don't know, there's just enough of that already in science fiction or aspects of Afrofuturism. But I really wanted to feature the sound mirrors in Dungeness. Having known about it for years, I wanted to visit that site to build a relationship with that and to feature that somehow. And it just really felt quite natural to consider not just this defunct technology, but again, you know, with technology, there's always a link, usually with warfare or, you know, test trials with materials that are produced for war. But then kind of trying to strip down this relic to it just being a listening device. And then even looking at the epicness of it as well. I guess what's amazing about those monuments is, you know, in around 100 to maybe 200 years time, they won't be there anymore. They're literally just sinking and crumbling away as we speak. If you look at imagery within that film versus imagery in like the early 2000s, it looks different, you know. So that was very important, of course, as well as, you know, other sites like Gwenna Pitt, which had a naturally occurring, you know, amphitheater and was used religiously by the likes of John Wesley, popular Methodist. So yeah, there were these interests, I guess, for me to kind of use these sites and consider also, you know, the West as the exotic space instead of the other way around, because that's what you tend to have a lot with art and culture. You know, when it comes to talking about, you know, the exotic, it tends to be other than the West. But what if we kind of, you know, we pull that visor, that gaze or that vision around onto the West as well?
I was mesmerised by that answer. And also, it also evokes that losing of voice, which is mentioned in the text too, and then because it's this searching for the lost voice, and then an echo always of the lost voice, and beautifully poignant. Have we got any questions?
Initially, early on in your talk, you were talking about the danger of your hip-hop rap group becoming a glorified entertainment group, essentially. And the way you really used it was that performance in the gallery where you were sat with the sculpture on your head. I'm wondering, do you find any difference in the audience, you might say, between, let's say, an art gallery and somewhere outside an art gallery, another venues?
Yeah, I think I think outside of I was talking about this to a friend of mine the other day. I think outside of an art gallery, you're forgiven less for like mistakes. If you like come up short with something, then people are going to tell you about it. Whereas I think in a gallery space, I think people do speak their minds, but I don't know. You just kind of, it's more kind of free flowy in a way. You can just throw that out there, and because you're an artist, you can say that. But I think in other types of public spaces or venues, as it were, you can be open much more to criticism or even questions, which I think is valid. I enjoy that. I think as much as it's great to do and say what I want, it should be opened up for question. I think, you know, artists should be open to be able to having conversations around what they've made or what they've said. I'd say those are the kinds of differences, you know, like taking the audio or the beat tapes and you know, performing those within, you know, atmospheres where people, you know, they love their beats and hip hop and stuff. You know, getting respect from people in those kinds of venues for me is enough, where if I go into a gallery space, I don't give a shit what you think. I really don't. Like, I care more about, you know, the so-called regular, you know, person who comes along to see the work. I think another, in a way, a kind of melting pot of that example of both, like, you know, kind of like art space, but then a venue where just a range of people come to is the opportunity I had with Tate Liverpool recently, which is very different to Tate Modern, I think, in terms of, you know, it's you know, attendeeship or whatever. You know, there were just loads of like, you know, young kids and families and just people from all kinds of walks of life that just felt like that, you know, they're actually people from Liverpool, not simply just, you know, people who I don't know, looking at stuff from a touristic kind of perspective. And, you know, having conversations with people where people really want to know what's going on, or like, well, I don't think that really works. It's that to me was a really enjoyable thing. So, yeah.
Can I just extend that idea a little bit, thinking about, you talked about working with groups, talking about veterans and people in certain groups in prisons and migrant groups. So I was really interested when we spoke, even when we were speaking earlier, but so what happens to that voice when you use that voice in a gallery? Well, does it seem two different strands when you have that relationship, you build up that dialogue, you explore some ideas, and then you turn that to the gallery seems an odd place for us, the end. Odd is the wrong word, but it seems like there's a gap for me between those two.
To me, it feels like
process.
I don't know. To me, it feels like a necessary space. If you're going to talk about, or if you're going to utilise, you know, hip-hop and look at, I don't know, like ICE or grills and that kind of stuff, but you're not going to talk about the experiences of, I don't know, working class parents and things like that, it feels like you're just trying to isolate a certain thing over the other and therefore create something, you know, glamorous. I think with what David and I are doing is, you know, we're trying to allow stories that don't have the light of day to be presented or perspectives. Like I said, you know, just kind of like, I don't know, seeing like newspapers as a kid through to now, the way that language is very specifically used and charged and thrown out there. You know, there's sometimes you wanna kind of wrestle with that. And, you know, I wouldn't say that we even tried to control any of the voices that that decided to be a part of the project. It was really just creating a space or a platform for, you know, for that agency and urgency to appear.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that those voices shouldn't be in the gallery.
Yeah.
I was just very curious about your process of that way of making work and forming and developing a relationship with a certain group, and then what happens to that material? How you move that material?
Well, you know, like traveling up to Liverpool, spending hours on end with the veterans in prison, like even the journey into the prison. Once you get to the area itself, I don't know how many of you have been to inside of a prison before, but just that whole thing of stripping and taking off, you know, stuff that you can't use to, apparently you may use to contact people, or you know, any metals and that kind of thing. To then just being in a room where you're just talking on a human level, to then even being outside of those spaces and talking with the families as well. I forgot to mention we work with the families as well of the veterans, and listened a lot to their experience of their doing time, because you know, if the veterans are doing time in there, they're also doing time because they're without their loved ones and so on. You're hearing a lot about that trauma. I think it taught David and I think a valuable lesson of actually just listening. I think that's, you know, sometimes people just don't like to listen to things, or they wait to speak. Whereas I think in this case, you know, even if the only case where we made edits where we would ask the question of, okay, is this actually what you meant, or did we, you know, write that down wrong in relation to what you vocally said? So we wanted to make sure that truth came out as clearly as possible, as directly as possible.
Those narratives come out with the avatars, don't they? And that's such a compelling space that you create for them, stripped back.
Yeah.
So you're just left confronted.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the environment isn't Grand Theft Auto, as some of you may know it. You don't have like the, I don't know, people getting run over and like guns being shot and stuff like that. It's just the landscape itself, which for us was the very interesting part of that. I think when you look at virtualized landscapes, that is it's a very compelling one, because there's so much that game has to offer with all the missions, but there is then so much of this kind of like sublime. It's like you're walking in a painting for eons, you know. So we tried to capture and bring that out visually.
Thank you.
First of all, really, really, really great to hear you speak. Really great to hear the soundtrack to the last work as well. I thought that was absolutely incredible. I wanted to know if you could talk a bit more about, or actually I'll start with an observation from sort of the earliest works that you spoke about right until the end. There was a like ongoing thing of like series or sequels or trilogies or something that followed on from sort of an original starting point. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that possibly, and also about how you kind of, what pinning fictional narratives does in relation to things that are already existing or you're already thinking about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, I think when I first left the Slade, the way that I was making work the first few years was just thinking about individual artworks, you know, just showing an artwork, as it were, and, you know, you've been invited to show something, okay, I'm going to show that. And it was only after a few years where being invited to consider an actual project where I thought, okay, well, maybe there's a way to build, you know, a body of work and to band that together as part of something, and then maybe to allow some of the points of that work to kind of, you know, make their way into other works that will grow into something else. Also, that has something for me to do with resources. You know, I can't make all of these things in one go, so I have to have time to be able to, you know, create that beat tape or whatnot that will kind of infuse and bring with it bits of, I don't know, found sounds that become a testimony, you know. I guess, yeah, being someone who's really into video games and seeing, you know, for better and worse, you know, sequels within video game structures, this idea of like side stories and things like that, I'm really interested in that. And then I think artists, looking at the, you know, the trajectories of artists like Donald Rodney or, you know, Smoking Dogs, Jonah Comfra, I feel like there is, if you look at some of those practices, even Labane Himid, there's something that kind of joins the work from one thing to the other, but each of the works that they make, they can kind of, you know, separately exist in their own right. But yeah, resources is a big thing, you know, so you can notice with the Cloudface pieces, you know, I only had like a crack copy of Adobe Suite to be able to mess around with that I couldn't use very well. But it's just about using those basic resources that I could get my hand on, you know, and then that follows its way through to being able to you know, afford a cheap beat making machine. You know, all of that stuff, again, I produced that, you know, within a bedroom studio production type situation. You know, I didn't take that to anyone to mix down. It's only later on where, you know, there becomes a bit more of an opportunity where I'm able to kind of open that up a bit more. But yeah, I don't know. I don't, nowadays I try not to think about the ideas that I have as, okay, you said enough about this, now you need to move on. But maybe what is the link between this conversation I'm having here? I don't know. Let's take like Relic Travel, for example. What link in conversations might I be able to have with the situation of that environment and bring that into an ecological kind of conversation? You know, because there is something to be had there. So how can I open that up? Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, there's lots of things I've been asking you. It's a very powerful presentation. But I have personal experience of people in prison, including me, and I think you were talking about storybook dads, were you?
Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Storybook dads?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and there was another thing around alongside that called Stories Connect. So anyone who walks in there, corridors of power, which a prison is, isn't it? It's a very powerful place.
Yeah.
But to be able to leave again afterwards is also quite powerful.
Mm.
But to leave space for people's imagination and to connect with the children through stories, I take my hat off to you and others like you
appreciate that, thank you. I mean, even just thinking about that now, to be honest with you, just the whole thing of freedom or the restriction of that within those kinds of spaces is really harrowing to me. I don't deal well personally with being, you know, like held against my will. And I think when I went into the other prison in Belmarsh, and then later with David in Liverpool, we went to Orcus. It kind of sparked off the memory of my mum visiting my uncle not too far from Heathrow Airport at this detention centre, and just noticing directly, not even just parallels, but just the fact that that was a prison as well. So many doors upon doors, and you know, people being held in that particular space where they didn't know when they might be let out, what they were being held there for, that kind of thing. It's difficult to try and bring that into a conversation without it feeling like you're maybe being preachy. So I think having that time to spend with even, you know, the veterans, and to allow that platform or space for them to really, you know, say their own stories. And that's not saying that, you know, they are angels themselves. None of us are. But really, just allowing that platform was just felt so important, because I think one of the things I noticed over the years with, I guess, conversations on the likes of like Facebook, when it comes to talking about things like war and everything, you know, people are very quick to talk about that kind of stuff. But there very rarely is that consideration of what happens to those bodies of the people that are sent out to kill or to do, you know, unspeakable things, and what happens to them in terms of rehabilitation or the lack thereof, right? So, I mean, for me, that's something I'm still working out in my mind, and how those conversations we have them, how we put them out there, because, it's such a horrible environment, right? But it needs to be spoken about, and all of those types of conditions and experiences that people have. So yeah, thank you for your point.
Hello. Interesting work. I found your work really interesting, because stupid question. I found you like face mask. I forgot what you call it. Those things at the beginning where you were. Yeah, those were really funny. And you mentioned you had to do some breathing exercises beforehand.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in what those were.
Yeah, they were just like meditative breathing exercises, because I think what tends to happen when you're in a constricted space is the way that you panic, your body obviously demands more air than what you can get, and you'll pass out because, you know, you kind of you become like euphoric, as it were. And as you can imagine, being you're pretty much within a closed space in this polystyrene helmet, I'd spend like up to an hour or two just like sitting there. I kind of cheated a bit because I had music in the background to keep me going. So I'd like think about the lyrics of tracks, and then of course that would make time move much more quickly. But I needed to do that because of course, obviously, I'm going to be doing a performance, and it's no good if I'm just sitting there one moment and then I'm falling down the next. So I put myself through the whole like experience really intensively. I needed to do it myself as well. I didn't feel comfortable with asking someone to do that. Maybe now it would be different because I've gone through that and done it myself, you know, and then I can have that conversation where it's an actual, you know, collaboration, but I felt like I needed to put that through there. But yeah, I think you made a really interesting point. There is definitely an aspect of humour to the, you know, the cloud face motif, as it were, which I think people do you know, find sometime to hear people like laughing or chuckling and whatnot. And I think, yeah, I think humour can be an important tool to art sometimes. And yeah, that definitely has that in there.
We're just about out of time. Two things. Your work's up at the Sculpture Park at the moment, the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. So for those of us going on the trip on Friday, we get to see the work in the flesh, which is fantastic. Everybody else needs to go. We will be going to the Red Lion for a drink straight away, so you're all very welcome. Come and join us there and continue talking to Larry. I think that was just an amazing talk, so thank you very much, Larry.